Jerzy Kuzinski, I'd like to have you describe for us, to sketch for us, what you've done in your new novel.
In Passion Play?
Yes.
Well, how do you describe 300 and some pages? I think very briefly it's a story of a middle-aged man, a polo player by profession, but also a writer who writes books on equestrian art. A man who used to be rich in the past when he played polo with the rich and played for them, but somehow in the last some years of his life is rich no more. Now, I repeat, he's a polo player, and hence he's at the mercy of people who can and might play polo with him, and there are very few people in this country who play polo. He travels across the United States in a mobile home in which he lives, which is in fact his whole way of life. And in it, he has two horses, neither of which is an ideal polo pony. One is an American saddle horse, and one is a Tennessee walking horse. For those who don't know, polo is basically played on thoroughbreds. And to play a good game of polo, you need from 4 to 8 horses. He has, I repeat, only 2. Hence, he makes his living looking for rich polo players who would play with him not on a team, but one-on-one, a sort of a duel for bets, for money, for stakes. One reason he is not playing on a polo team is that he was known to be a maverick, a too good a player, who would very often upset the collectivity of a team. This is basically the man. The book portrays his predicament at a very crucial moment in his life, in which he inadvertently kills one of his friends in a polo duel. It was more than a game. It was, in fact, a duel. There was a woman involved. And a part of his life when he gets involved with a very young and very well-to-do woman, a woman who is, in fact, who could be his daughter, to say the least, and who could and want, who could change his way of life and who intends to change his way of life by making a substantial gift to him, and why he doesn't take this gift. In other words, what happens to him at this crucial moment in his life when he's more than ever before confronted with his past and with his present, when the whole issue of what is passion for life and what is a mere play becomes far more obvious and far more painful to Fabian, the character in Passion Play. I might add that there is a substantial difference between Passion Play and the preceding 6 novels, since basically I think Passion Play starts a different cycle in my books.
In what way?
In a way that in all my previous novels, in The Painted Bird, in Steps, being the Devil Tree, Cockpit and Blind Date, the central character would always define himself or herself by defending himself or herself against the environment. This was the act of definition, of finding who you are always by contrast with others. Fabian, in Passion Play, defines himself by his gift, by his ability to play polo, by his what he considers to be the essence of his life. And he's not going to be changed or corrupted by anything or anyone else. In such a way, I think, he is the first character I have created who has a sense of mission in his own life. His own life is his mission, and a sense of destiny. He's not going to, he's not going to trespass anybody else's property. He will not avenge himself in any way. He will merely be, until he dies, what he actually is. And Passion Play is about that very process of self-definition at a very crucial moment in his life, when he has to know what it is that he is, who he is, and why he cannot become somebody else.
To what extent did you draw on your own life in building the character and in forming the novel?
I guess, as always, what I try to do is to write about something that I know very well, firsthand. Not because I have to, but because I like to. Middle age, obviously, is what I know myself. Fabian is an equestrian sportsman, so am I. I play polo, so does he. He writes books which are not very popular on equestrian art. I write books which are not very popular on human art, on the art of human conduct. Polo became a good metaphor for the character, since regardless of the fact that it is not a very well-known game in the United States, one reason, by the way, it is not a well-known game is that neither film cameras nor television cameras can portray it well. They just can't. The polo field is too big. It's 10 times the size of a football field. And so it hasn't made it as a popular entertainment through television or through film. But outside of this, polo is a very American sport, and that's why I like to play it. It's played on a Western horse throughout the United States. It involves a polo player who's a bit like a cowboy, very mobile, very free, supercharged. It involves stick and ball, which Americans know very well from, golf, hockey, golf. It involves collision of two teams. You do it in hockey, in roller derby, in football. Hence, it has all American components. It was a perfect sport for the novel, but it just so happened that I know it and I like it and I play it, and so I use it. Other than that, I used some of my history. When I came to the United States, I was a truck driver, and I used to drive across the hot states. These are the very states where people play polo, and these are the very states through which Fabian now drives his mobile home, his van home. And perhaps another similarity, Fabian travels a lot, had traveled a lot when he was rich, when he played with the rich. There was time in my life when I was part of a very rich way of life. I was married to a woman who was very well-to-do. She died 10 years ago. And so I committed to Fabian this part of my life, which again I know very well. What it is to be among those who are truly the super rich. And what it is to be rich no more.
Another of Fabian's interests in your book, Passion Play, is young girls and active sexuality. What did you do to get into the mind of a middle-aged man who is very attracted to
Well, it's very
girls?
Easy for me to get into the mind of a middle-aged man since I live in the body of a middle-aged man.
No, I said a middle-aged man who's very attracted by young girls. I don't know what your preferences or attractions are.
I very often don't know myself, frankly. I think one way I find out is to write about it, I guess. I don't think I'm attracted by youth itself, certainly not. From this point of view, I don't think I would look at someone in terms of age, sexually or otherwise, frankly. I might say that Fabian is not merely attracted to young women because he's attracted them sexually. I think the primary reason for his attraction is that to young women, to very young women whom he meets at various stables, to these young women, he appears to be a romantic figure. To everybody else in American society, he would be a grotesque figure. Hence, he's not after sex. He's after a redeeming image of himself. When he meets them for the first time, and they are very, very, very young, I repeat, they see him as a romantic, heroic figure, a man who arrives with his horses in his van, a man who's free from the influence of community, police, school, a man who's a famous equestrian, a master, a man who's a polo player, a man who writes books about equestrian art, books they have to read to write well. So this is what he's there after for the first time. When he visits them second time, and this is part of his plot, in a way, of redeeming himself, he comes twice to their lives. Once for the first time, the hero, the romantic man. The second time he appears in their lives when they are already young women, legally of age. Still, very little time elapsed, for him at least, from his first visit to his next visit. To them, however, things change substantially. And so now he comes to their life as a potential lover, but also as a man whom they remember as a figure of fantasy, as a romantic man who met them once when they had little to offer. Now, of course, they can offer him much more. So I repeat, he comes there and he returns for an image of himself, an image that he needs to keep on going, just as frankly, I need my image and you yours to deal with ourselves doing what we are doing. In other words, being redeemed by others is a very important part of our life. I have a feeling that, for me at least, sexual attraction is based on that aspect of being redeemed by someone who recognizes you as a potential lover, who recognizes you as a romantic figure, heroic figure, knowledgeable figure, attractive figure, sexual figure. It is not just the touch of two bodies. It's clearly a recognition. It's an act similar to that between a reader and a writer, in which the reader is so much on target that the writer says to the reader, my God, you could have written my book.
In some love relationships, that type of thing gets very messy. I know some people have left relationships at the point when they felt that their function in the relationship was to reflect back wonderful things about their lover, to be like a looking glass, a mm-hmm. positive looking glass, or a beautiful reflecting pool, as opposed to someone with a very distinct personality of
That's
their
own. That's an interesting insight, in a way. In terms of passion play, what you said right now, and I'm learning now from you about my own book, perhaps that's why Vanessa doesn't want to be anymore merely a redeeming factor in Fabian's life. She wants to influence his life by a gift so staggering. She's very well-to-do. But a gift so enormous that, in fact, it would remake him altogether. And so he would no longer need to be a grotesque figure in search of her to redeem him. Maybe that's why. It's very interesting. Well, one learns something in these programs.
If you don't mind my bringing up one of the things that happens towards the end, one of the things that does happen is that Vanessa sleeps for the first time with a man, and that man is
Fabian.
Of course,
they have known each other sexually before, but without an intercourse.
Without and intercourse,
Fabian simply would not want to do it. She was not of age yet, and he had a very specific fear that he would be, that he would commit an important act, but also an illegal act, that he in fact could be somehow caught.
One of the things that I wanted to know, and mm-hmm. that I would want to know in a situation like this, is, gee, was she using birth control? Here she is, a virgin, never done this before. She thought about getting pregnant. Did the writer give her birth control?
We might as well say that the act takes place in a place which is basically a swingers place, where Fabian takes her for the first time in her life, as if to indicate the various functions sex might play in a grown-up society. And so in a most unlikely, I think it's probably the first romantic scene. It was very romantic for me when I wrote it. That takes place in a Ansonia type public swinging sex place. I really don't know. You'll have to ask Vanessa. This is something which I think Fabian would probably know or would have feel. I think
he didn't ask.
I don't think that he would have to ask. I think one feels it after all. Maybe he was careful. We don't know whether there was an orgasm involved and what kind of an orgasm. I mean, these are things that lovers keep private, even in my novels.
That is one of the very erotic scenes within your book. Would you expect that readers of your book might masturbate while reading it, that your book, in a way, might become, for some readers, a tool similar to, you know, erotica or, of course it is erotic, or pornography, which some people specifically run out and purchase for those reasons.
I would feel that the kind of readers who read my novels, who read the novels of Jerzy Kosinski, are not the readers who masturbate. I have a feeling that if they read my books, they obviously have reached a certain level of self-awareness in their life, and they would know how to go about the sexual release, perhaps in a more rewarding way. I have a feeling that masturbation, basically, in most cases, is an infantile process. I somehow don't associate my novels with that sort of a mentality. As far as being aroused, I guess one can be aroused by all kinds of things in fiction. I doubt, again, that my novels are written, that the sexual passages in my novels are written in an arousing fashion. I think they are, for instance, you ask certain questions right now about technical aspects of lovemaking between Fabian and Vanessa. I have a feeling that I leave much more to imagination. And in such a way, I think maybe there's a less of a graphic element in sexually in my novels than one would expect. I think that the topography is more situational, and the motives are more important than actual description of the sex act itself.
Are those descriptions hard to write?
I guess anything is hard
fresh
to write.
Description of...
Possibly, yes, since it has been raped so often. The language has been raped, the situations have been raped by pornography, by pulp novels. I think what distinguishes, I would imagine, a perceptively written scene, whether it's a radio program or lovemaking, is how it portrays the motives of those who are involved, rather than the acts. The acts are banal. We all know them. People embraced more or less the same way, whether in privacy of their bedroom or in a swingers saloon. I think what sets us apart is what we think about ourselves in the act, about others, why we do what we do, why we don't do what we do, what we don't do. I think that is possibly the difference. I like to think that that's how I think about it, and that's how I write it.
You said before that you didn't think your readers would be the type of readers that would masturbate.
Who would have to masturbate because of fiction, yes.
Who is your favorite reader? Who is your ideal reader who picks up one of your books?
I think I would imagine my ideal reader to be quite close to some of my characters, in fact. That's why I think they would communicate. It would be a man or a woman quite conscious of his or her place in society, quite aware of the threat that society poses to one's self, to one's development, to one's psyche, and who'd be quite willing to see oneself as a potential survivor from moment to moment against these threats or in spite of some of the attempts. In other words, someone who would be very possessive about one's morality, ethics, sexuality, way of life. Someone who would see himself or herself in the predicament my characters do. The Man in Steps, Jonathan Whalen in The Devil Tree, Tarden in Cockpit.
I can think of the main character and being there who wouldn't know how to read.
This is, of course, one novel of the preceding cycle of my six novels, which deals with the total absence of the self. Only by showing someone who has no self, I would in fact indicate what it is to have self. Hence, Being There was the third novel in the center of that first six books. It portrays a man who is in fact an empty vessel. Hence, he becomes an instrument used entirely by societal forces he neither understands nor even perceives. But ironically, he's also used by those for the benefit of those through television who have also lost any sense of self. And only they, such people who don't know themselves anymore, would also be not able to recognize that he is an empty vessel. And so they all think he has a lot to offer, and he has nothing to offer.
Jerzy Kosinski, what kind of reader are you? Do you read many novels?
I guess I'm an average reader. I read a lot of fiction and nonfiction, both. But since I'm also a writer from time to time, during the time when I write, I tend to stay away from novels, as if to protect my own voice and my own. I don't want to argue with anybody else's vision then. I'm rather trying to figure out what it is that I want to write. Why do I think that what I write, I should write? There's a slight fear in me that if I'm going to start reading novels by other writers, I might be intimidated and I will not write my own. And so at these moments in my life, I prefer to play polo, ski. I do a lot of work for human rights, and therefore I also read a lot of nonfiction then. And all those activities which keep me apart and away from the creative process of writing fiction, of writing my own novel.
All the writing that you've done, to my knowledge, has been in English, which is not your native tongue.
No. Mm-hmm.
Your native tongue is Polish.
Polish and partly Russian.
From what I've read, you picked up English very quickly. At what point were you thinking in the English language?
I think when I arrived here, I was 24, and I knew I wasn't going back. I think that awareness, the moment when you know that you are not going back not only to your past country, but also to your past, that you are finished with what you have been until this moment, that's when thinking in another language begins, even if you don't know the language yet. In other words, I remember very well that in my first weeks in New York, I was not anymore thinking in Polish, though not quite yet thinking in articulate English, but I would already think in terms of images I would see around me, tall buildings, differently looking people, slogans, titles of films, headlines in newspapers. I might add, I was not entirely without a language. I was a social scientist. I knew Latin. I knew French. I managed in Italian and Spanish. In other words, when I arrived in New York, I was not an infant who didn't know how to take care of himself. I was 24. I began writing creatively in about 6 or 7 months, and I wrote my first two books on nonfiction. Already in English, while getting my degree at university in New York. And so I began learning by both imitating, reading, but also by writing. And since I have never written anything before, in other words, I did not come to this country as a writer, an accomplished writer who used to write in his previous existence. I was merely a social scientist who used photography to express himself. Hence, when I arrived in New York and I started to use the typewriter, it was for the first time in my life, and just as well, that I started in English and I have continued to write in English.
Have you ever felt that there are certain types of thoughts or certain forms of description that work best in certain languages? Does English lend itself more, as far as you can tell, mm-hmm. to certain types of forms
or yes,
descriptions than French or Polish?
I think most of us who grew up in another language very often compare notes on the subject. For instance, very often I talked about it with Roman Polanski, who grew up in Poland, Miloš Forman, the movie director who directed One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Hair, who grew up in Czechoslovakia, Louis Malle, who has grown up in France, and many, many others. And if there's one area where we really agree, is that in English we can express ourselves with far greater degree of freedom. Now, I don't mean political aspect of it. I mean that the body of the language itself gives way to a much larger spectrum of both being concrete and being vague at the same time. That our own respective languages, Polish, Czechoslovak, French, are much more demanding of a specific mood, of a specific activity. For instance, in the area of sexuality, English is much more open. I think Shakespeare opened it up somehow. There's an enormous ambiguity in English also, that if you want, you can see an act as concrete, but if you don't want, you can see it as an abstract. There's a great strength in English verb, and the noun is very powerful. You can say, he entered the room, and that's a sentence, and a powerful one. Or he entered, period. Our languages would require a bit more of adjectives and adverbs. Hence, to us, for creative purposes, we simply love functioning in English.
What about the way the tongue moves in the mouth with different languages and just the sound of the speech itself, the sound of the words?
Quite different. In other words, Polish, for instance, would be much more onomatopoeic. The language would convey through its sounds the process that it describes, almost as if imitating nature. Well, English is less sound-oriented. It's more expression-oriented rather than mere sound. For instance, when we describe in Polish the sounds that make noises, the language itself says "ch, sh, ch," all the things that make you now move away from your speakers. English doesn't have that.
I imagine that your novels have been translated into Polish.
In fragments, but never entirely.
Oh, I'm really surprised. Why is that?
Well, I guess the communist government doesn't want to popularize someone who got out from Poland and who somehow managed to survive in the West, even though he retained his own name. I never even changed my name. In other words, my example, just as the example of Miloš Forman or Ivan Passer, another filmmaker, or Roman Polanski, indicates that you can do both in the West. You can be yourself. You don't have to sacrifice your past. You can admit to what you were and who you are and yet be very creative in the new language, in the new society. They don't like this as an example. Too many people would run away. Look at the Russian defectors. Why do you think they defect? Because they know the example of Baryshnikov. Because they know the example of Nureyev. Because they know possibly of our example.
People leaving and becoming stars as opposed to suffering.
Exactly. They know that they can continue to dance here, that they can continue to express themselves here in spite of what they are told there, that the minute they will arrive here and be on their own, they will starve to death, or that they will have to work for CIA.
You've probably read the excerpts of your work that has been translated into Polish.
Yes, I did.
What do you think of the translation? How does it feel to you?
I think translation was excellent. But what I think where it suffered was not the translator's fault. For instance, it was a fragment from Steps, I recall very vividly, that was translated. And Steps is written in a very cryptic, direct way. I think Polish requires, as I said before, a bit more of an adornment. And the Polish text in translation reads a bit, well, it's a bit too stark. You have a feeling that something is missing there. At least this was my impression. Maybe the new generation of Poles reading Polish today would not think so. But I left 22 years ago, and I lost contact with Eastern Europe, really. I don't know what people read in Poland or in the Soviet Union or in Czechoslovakia.
If you're just joining us, my guest is novelist Jerzy Kaczynski, who has just written a new novel, and that new novel is called Passion Play. You were a young boy during and shortly after World War II. You were alone, a young boy alone, for a good deal of that time. You did a lot of real suffering. From what I've read about you, I read about a time when you were about 9 and were attacked by a group of people and that you didn't speak for 5 years after that very mm-hmm. horrible experience. It sounds like that was just one of some really awful things that happened to you.
Well, but awful things that happened to me happened in a context which was far worse to millions of others, or at least to thousands of others I could see. Hence, in this context, or in that context, these things were not as awful. I think it's very important to remember that
because there were people going off in boxcars.
Yes, there were people being taken to concentration camps. Peasants used to be killed by the German units or partisan units. We saw people being hanged by their legs or by God knows what. We saw kids of my age have seen almost everything there was to see. And a lot of us have done a lot. Not necessarily the best things to remember. What I'm saying is that any experience is relative in terms of the psyche that perceives it. Being slapped by an American parent in a middle-class family may be just as traumatic to an American kid in a suburban community as being, let's say, beaten by a group of people was to me at the time. You could lose speech because of your American experience in the context of your life. And I was traumatized. I drowned also at the time. I was thrown into a manure pit. That may have had something to do with it. And for 5.5 years, I simply didn't speak. Again, I don't look at that period as being victimized, since I remember very well that among those who could not speak in the orphanage after the war, most of them had no mouth left very often, or no nose, or no chin. Again, by comparison, I was a very privileged person. I merely kept silent, I said to myself. I was not physically crippled. I was not visibly deformed. And so when I look back at my experience in Eastern Europe, I never see myself. I didn't then, and I don't now, as being singled out to become a victim. I see myself primarily as one of great number of those who suffered because of terrible historical process, because of Holocaust, because of the Second World War, because of the Nazis, because of the Soviets, because of all kinds of oppression. But I don't see myself as a particular victim. Hence, I refuse to write anything directly autobiographically, since I have a feeling that my experience belongs to millions and millions of people. God knows, one day even to young Americans. Certainly a lot of Americans who travel in Latin America know what is happening there. A lot of Americans who came from Vietnam know what used to go on there. Look at the boat people right now. Go to Latin America, where I go once in a while, to Dominican Republic, to Argentina, to Mexico. We are surrounded by the sea of staggering suffering.
So you grew up in such suffering that being attacked and drowning in manure...
It was an event of life, in fact, no worse than a lot of other things that were taken. I could have been killed,
now,
and I wasn't.
How does this affect your view of what goes around you now? Do you think that the things that might strike you as being terrible would seem less terrible because
I don't think
the
so.
Standards that
no.
you grew up with
no,
were so different?
No, I don't think so. I think it makes me much more aware, I think, of the context, of the terrible things that might not appear terrible to anyone else. I for instance, find very often conditions of going to work in the United States. Tragic and terrible. People losing half of their productive life, sitting in small boxes, which are miniature living rooms, on a freeway which doesn't go anywhere, on a highway that doesn't move, going to an office where they cannot open a window. I find environment very oppressive. In other words, what I'm saying is this. I think the yardstick we have, by this I mean the generation of people who grew up being traumatized by various societal forces, I think we pay enormous attention to life itself, to being able to breathe, to enjoy the walk, to knowing what it is that bothers you, to confront it as directly as possible. You may have noticed that my fiction upsets a lot of critics. They criticize me for writing about sex and writing about violence, as if somehow the purpose of fiction was to avoid it and to make you comfortable. Well, it isn't. The purpose of fiction to us always was to make you as aware, hence very often uncomfortable, about your environment. Now, you can achieve it only by portraying it in a rather drastic terms, the way I do it in my novels. Hadn't I read novels which portrayed strong characters defending themselves against oppression in American authors, in Melville, in Theodore Dreiser, in Upton Sinclair, Sinclair Lewis, Fenimore Cooper, Jack London, I mean, heroic figures. Without these examples, I would not have seen myself as being oppressed, and I would not have gotten out of Eastern Europe.
You have been very poor, and you have been very rich. As you were explaining before, you were very poor when you were a child and had no family, had nothing.
Penniless when I arrived in the United States.
And you were very rich when you married...
Yes.
A woman who passed away about 10 years ago who had quite an inheritance
mm-hmm.
of her own. Did your
she was quite likely one of the richest individuals in this country at the time.
Did your politics change between being very rich
no,
and being
not
very
at
poor?
All. I mean, in fact, you can even my life indicates that for some reason, like Fabian, I also turned down the gift of love. I refused to have my life changed by it. I kept writing my books. I wrote The Painted Bird, a book about a homeless, abandoned child in the very midst of my marriage. Now, clearly, it's an interesting phenomenon that of all the things I could have done, in the midst of such a marriage, in which the whole world was a playground, open to any kind of an activity, I would sit down to write about the very essence of terror and the very essence of persecution and the very essence of suffering.
Did the safeness and security of the relationship and of that amount of money enable you to go back into that type of suffering?
No, I don't think so. I think I went back to this suffering fictionally, to write a novel about it, to remind myself, in fact, that the core of life is not the exterior. That it is basically what it is, what it was in my case, my childhood, my growing up. And by giving this to my environment, to Americans, so as my first novel, and to my wife, to whom the book was inscribed at the time, dedicated, what I was in fact doing, I think, I look at it now, in retrospect, I was in fact saying two things. I was saying, you might need this gift yourself, because you know nothing about these things. You know nothing about what it is to be a homeless boy or a homeless child. You know nothing about terror and potential trauma and actual trauma. And you may use it. It may be useful. But I was also saying, this is my calling card. Remember, this is what I am. Don't forget for a minute that this is what is the substance of my life. And therefore, don't assume that you can ultimately sway me into your way of life. I'm going to be a visitor. I'm going to be a writer. And so I remain writing novels, even though obviously I could have done other things. I could have become a corporate person. I could have worked for the family business. I could have run a chain of hotels. I don't know. I could have been in charge of foreign investments here and there. Offers were made. I was a perfectly reliable young man who wrote two books in social science and a good novel.
You could have not worked.
I could have not worked.
Did you think of that?
Of course.
Stopping altogether?
A bit like Fabian in Passion Play, I think. I decided I was going to do what was the essence of my life. I had a sense of destiny. My private destiny. My private destiny was to be as close to what Jerzy Kosinski really is. And so I started with The Painted Bird. Then I went to Steps, to the Devil Tree, to being there, the Devil Tree. Ironically, Being There was written shortly after my wife died, and in a curious way, it points out that one happens to a character who's entirely formed by the rich environment. The book is coming as a movie. It's coming in.
Being There is becoming a movie?
It has already become. It will be released early next year.
Oh, that's
Peter Sellers portrays Chauncey Gardner, and Shirley MacLaine portrays Eve Rand. Melvin Douglas, Benjamin Rand, and Hal Ashby directed. So Being There was in fact another reminder, as if to myself, after my wife died, that I would not want to become a product of an environment, since after all, I had my own self to worry about and to live.
There was an interesting prank that was done a few years ago. I wonder how you reacted to this. A writer submitted one of your books, Steps, to a lot of publishers.
To all publishers.
To all publishers, with his own name on it, an unknown name.
To all literary agents, yes.
So it was your book, which had won a National Book Award a few
years
earlier.
10 years earlier. He had done it actually this year.
Oh, was this year?
Yes.
I thought it was before that.
Yes.
And he even sent it to the publisher that it was published by.
Oh, yes. He sent it to all the publishers of Jerzy Kosinski.
None of them recognized it.
That's right. They all sent it back.
They rejected it. What did you think of that? What kind of...
I think it was an interesting experiment. I knew that he was going to do it because at one point he had done part of it. He had submitted just one chapter. And the same thing happened because nobody recognized. Everyone turned it down. And then I was lecturing at UCLA and he got up and he said, Mr. Kosinski, what did you think about my experiment with one chapter? And I said, well, it was unfair. I wrote the whole novel. The least you could have done in your experiment was to submit the whole novel. After my remark at UCLA, he did exactly that. And so he then submitted the whole book, as you said, under different title, different name, but of course, word for word, the way Jerzy Kosinski wrote Steps. What's interesting about it is this. One, that no one recognized it, even though they published it themselves, and even though, as you say, the book won the National Book Award. What is, however, far more interesting is how they turned it down. He described this experiment in the New West magazine in California, and the letters he got, most of these letters, pointed out that the book, that Steps, was too stark, that it made a reader too uncomfortable. What I deduct from it is that we have turned much more sentimental now in the 70s, more now in 1979, at least the industry, the publishing industry, maybe the reviewers as well. Maybe that's why I get relatively bad reviews for my books in the last 7 or 8 years, because I think they're not sentimental, and maybe the culture tends to become more sentimental. Because ironically, Steps was published in 1968, and there were several publishers at the time who were willing to publish Steps In 1979, not a single publisher and not even a single agent who would merely submit it for publication. And so I have a feeling that what happened to us is possibly unfortunate, that certain middle-class values, and maybe not the best ones right now, and that is that one should never disturb the reader, that the reader should be always comfortable, in charge of what he or she reads. Puzzled, yes, but not disturbed. Maybe from time to time certain things should be pinpointed, but in such a way that the reader would always remain in a position of critical superiority. You would know what's happening there, and it doesn't bother you, and you can deal with it. Maybe because of this we are getting so few books, so few novels, that actually do something to you, that want you to change your life in some way.
I had assumed that this person who sent your books with his name on it was also trying to show how close-minded publishers are to unknown quantities, to authors who don't already have a track record.
That's right. And he, of course, had proven the point in a way. But I think far more important is that sentimental issue, that today no one would touch a book simply because it is too direct. It addresses itself to a specific American experience in terms which could, in my view, could benefit you and me, because we have to address ourselves to that environment exactly as directly as this. Not through refraction, not through a filter of comedy, not through a filter of that happy fella, not through a filter of Fiddler on the Roof, or some of the abstract novels which deal with psychoanalytical process, refractions, the puzzles and words, but through a very direct experience, the way you and I have to confront life when we go outside.
So you think that American audiences has changed and that the publishers have just changed along with them?
I think that I don't know what comes first. Maybe television, maybe the passive attitude vis-a-vis television, in which obviously nothing is going to challenge you so drastically on television, hence you're very comfortable. Maybe this made its way now to literature, that you're not supposed to write novels that are too directly confronted you sexually. I mean, what you said about sex in my novels is quite true. In other words, I try to portray sex as directly as it comes to me in life. Very direct force, a very important force in self-definition. Bureaucracy, very important force in defending yourself or in being somehow swept away by it. Various other terrors and ambiguities of life. My characters are not easily defined. Maybe that's too much. Maybe what they want today is easily defined character, a funny man, a Woody Allen character from Manhattan somehow, that you sit in the audience and you laugh, and you're slightly sad, and you slightly laugh, and you slightly empathize, but basically you never really confront it.
You as an author are in a very different position than the man who used his name on your book Steps when he submitted it to the publishers, because you are a known quantity. You are a well-known author whose work has been met with a lot of acclaim, and I wonder...
Well, be careful. My books are not readily published. I change publishers often, and some publishers change me. In other words, books are turned down. I'm not at all a massive best-selling author. I would think that in terms of both the audience I have, I really would consider myself a nicely rewarded marginal novelist. In other words, people who read me know why they read me. And I think they are rather faithful readers. And many of them, I think, identify with my characters or at least with the search for who you are. At the same time, I'll be very careful. I would not identify me as a popular novelist. Hence, the issue of being published, it's a very important issue for me. One day I might not be published. If this trend continues, I won't be published.
Have publishers or editors ever suggested to you that your work now is too stark or too hard or not sentimental enough?
They don't have to. Critics do.
Mm. You don't sound very enthusiastic about critics.
I don't sound enthusiastic about life, which excludes what, in my view, is the most important aspect of it, confronting it. And so it threatens me, not just because it threatens my novels. Look, there are many other things I can do in life. I have several other professions. If things are really bad, I will do what Fabian in Passion Play does. I will start playing polo or teach people how to play polo or write about polo. I don't know. I can teach. I used to teach. I am an accomplished photographer and a chemist. I'm a good skier. I can still teach people how to ski. In other words, I don't have to write novels, and I write novels very seldom. In 15 years of my life, I wrote only 7 books, 7 short novels. This is not a staggering accomplishment. Obviously, I could have done other things. What threatens me, of course I'm upset by reviews. I'm upset because I have a feeling that certain awareness is being taken away, not only from me, but from others as well. The very awareness which armed me once sufficiently for me to define my life. if it's going to be taken away from me now, I won't mind because I can take care of myself. But what about people like me 20 years ago? People who are young, who have to defend themselves and who have to see themselves as dramatic characters. Survivors in a specific threat posed by the changing American environment. This is not an easy society to live in. Let's remember that. It's a very violent society. It's a society in which when you're thrown out of work, you may have difficulty finding your job. I think the inflation will take giant part of American expectations away from those who expect them to be fulfilled. I think young Americans may start resembling young Europeans after the war more rapidly than they know. And what I'm saying, therefore, is that I think there's a use for a strong, confronting literature.
Jerzy Kaczynski, we are almost out of time. I'd like to ask you briefly what you see ahead in your own future.
I see old age in a sentimental society which doesn't like old people, which makes not many provisions for them, which sets them aside. And I have an uneasy feeling that most of us who are young now will be old one day. And so somehow, again, when I say that Passion plays about middle-aged protagonists, I'm not writing about another planet. I'm writing about you.